Good morning. Welcome to Rexomatic Records. Today we have a very special guest, and on the line with me to visit with our guest is Tom Hughes. Tom, are you there?
I am here.
And Andy Kern, are you there?
I'm here too.
Okay. Our guest today is Kerry Jackson. Kerry is a multiple instrumental musician who has gladly volunteered his time to visit today about not only his musical projects over the years, but also about his additions to the Big for His Age 2 album project. So I want to invite Kerry Jackson. Kerry Jackson, are you here?
I am on board, yes.
Okay. Well, great, Kerry. We appreciate you participating in this podcast. We're going to talk about all things musical, and we're going to start this off by turning you over to our friend Tom Hughes, who will get you started.
How are you doing, Kerry?
I am doing good, Tom. I haven't heard from you in years. That's awesome.
That's right. It's very good to talk to you. I was first thing, I just want to say that your debate with Donald Trump last night was remarkable. You turned him into a pile of quivering jello, which we all appreciate.
Shooting fish in a barrel, you know.
I've been keeping track of your remarkable career through Rex. And during this odd year, I'm wondering if you've had a lot more responsibility and work because people need people who can work from home and in their studios and send in virtual tracks to enhance their own music.
Well, fortunately, yes. You know, like in some ways, I'm not doing as much as I used to because I play so much live music, and I love playing live music. And me and my partner, Brant Hopkins, we have a duo and a band, and we were out there all the time playing. But like millions of other people, my last gig was right around St. Patrick's Day, right when the whole world changed. And even though we get a lot of offers and people have wanted me to play, I just, you know, I'm a healthy old guy right now, and to go in some little closed space right now,
right,
and play music as much as I want to, just doesn't seem worth risking my life for. So I haven't been doing any of that. But through the miracle of Zoom and all this wonderful technology, one fellow that I have an ongoing project with, Harold Patterson, I work with him, and I work with the wonderful engineer, Dave Nichols, who has also contributed so much to Rex and so much to Big for His Age 1 and 2. Fortunately, they have a lot of work, and we don't get to do as much as we want. I had gone over to Dave's home studio once or twice since March so I could play some bass. And even then we were all masked and I was in a separate room and we were being, you know, really careful. But fortunately we had a lot of work to do with mixing and manipulating stuff that we had already recorded. And thanks to the miracle of Zoom and stuff, I'm one of the lucky humans in this world who has had work this year, and I am still, you know, paying my rent and buying gas and getting along in life because of these wonderful computers. And I thank God every day that I'm able to do this music in whatever form still. And we're really grateful that we have so many home studios now with high quality equipment like Andy Kern. Mm-hmm. Was now, I really miss going over to Andy's house. The last few things we were doing on Big for His Age 2 were over at Andy Kern's house, where sometimes it'd be just me. Sometimes we'd have some singers and friends over all at once. I would sing with Rex. I would do overdubs while him and Andy were there to guide me. And then Andy was able to mix the album and do all that at home. So anyway, thank God for this technology. Had all this stuff happened to us, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, I don't know what we would have done, because we certainly wouldn't be able to go into recording studios.
Tell me, how has working virtually on your own home studio, your own digital home studio, how has that changed your work with different tracks? When you at what point are you hearing tracks and early tracks and later tracks? How do you How were you asked to fit into those tracks, and how do you decide what in your gut feels right or doesn't quite feel right for the music you're hearing?
Well, in the main projects, like Rex has, we get the world's greatest drummers, Gary Brazzisi, Dan Tomlinson, who's also featured all over Rex's recent record, as well as his first record.
Yes.
Fortunately, those guys have already been recorded, and we already got their wonderful tracks, but it's amazing how much you're able to do from home in the final mixes of the song. And I've been amazed when I'm on the Zoom with Dave Nichols, how much we're able to mix right down to the nth degree. And we've even done stuff like edited drums that we already have. And when I want to take out a kick drum, for instance, or whatever, which sounds very simple, but as you know, with live drums, that can be a huge process because the kick drum might be on like five different mics, you know, like you can hear the damn thing. Mm. So that alone could be a huge ask. It's just, hey, can we lose that one kick drum? Yeah, because that might take us half a day to figure out how to do it and not have it sound like we edited the drums, you know?
All right.
Kerry, this is Rex. We had a chance to visit with Steve Sutherland the other day. We did an interview with him, and, you know, he co-wrote the song "She Said, He Said" that was on the album.
Steve, yeah.
Yeah, and on that one, you know, Steve had pretty much laid the entire song out on his recording equipment up in Seattle and sent those tracks down to us, and then we kind of deconstructed the song and went back to the basics on it, you know, using very similar overall arrangements to what he was doing. But we kind of started by rebuilding with you and Andy Kern. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that process, because we started with what you guys did, and then we sent that up to Steve, and then Steve added his things to it, and then sent it back, and then we added drums to it. Kind of talk about that little map building process that you and Andy Kern went through.
Yeah, that was great. Well, and I have this wonderful Korg. It's a Kronos. And not only is it a beautiful keyboard with just, you know, the sounds are unbelievable and, you know, so wonderful, the state of the art, but it's also a fantastic little recording studio in itself. So fortunately, when Steve sent that down to Rex, and we thought it'd be better to build this song from scratch, because it was, you know, the original was a demo and it was a really good one, but it needed to be started over from scratch just to make it a little, you know, at the right tempo and a little cleaner and stuff. So I was able to take my keyboard over to Andy's house. Fortunately, before the pandemic, when things were still like that were still possible. And we kind of did it on the spot, where I just went over there with Andy and I would play the stuff, but we were both involved in it. You know, I've known Andy for, well, I was going to say 30 years, try like 38 years. Andy Kern is one of the great set of ears in our world. He's not only a great musician in his own right and can write and sing and play many things himself, but Andy's my favorite ears. Like if I did a song myself and I had the whole thing done, I would want Andy to hear it, because Andy gives you such an overall great listen and such a perspective of, oh, that's a little muddy there, or, you know, why don't you clear that up, or, you know, he's so good at that. So did you guys
start with kind of building the rhythm tracks first?
Yeah.
And then adding guitar?
Yeah. So on the Korg, I have access to 16 tracks. When they say 16 tracks on this thing, it really means 16 entire keyboards full of sound, you know, separate tracks. So you kind of, with a guitar in my lap, we just kind of sat here and I played some drums, first of all on the keyboard, so we could map out the song and get the template of the song itself and figure out, you know, how much of an intro, how many verses, you know, do we want it to end? Do we want it to fade out? You know, all of that kind of stuff. And then just built some basic drums first so we could play other instruments to them. Then I didn't even plug in a bass because the keyboard already has a lot of bass sounds, and we were just doing it as a guide anyway, knowing that we could play actual string bass later. So then I think I might have done drums first, so we knew that we had the template of the song. The wonderful thing about the keyboard is you're still not, you know, committed to the tempo. Like, you can change that at any time. It's like you don't have to hold yourself. I've always found that the best way to test a tempo is to sing the song along with what you've got. And as soon as the singing feels good and it feels natural and like you're not, you know, pulling back or you're not trying to rush, then you've usually got the right tempo. I think what I probably did was the drums, and then I think we probably threw down simple piano chords, mostly as a guide to know where we were in the song. So I wasn't really trying to play the piano track per se that would be like a performance, so that could come later. Just kind of throw down, here's this chord, then it changes to that chord. So now, after we had the drums and the piano, there's a template that you can play all the guitars over, you could sing over, you could put a bass line over. I think that we probably did bass next. So it wasn't long, just a few hours even, that we had a song that was already realized with, you know, the chords, a nice little bass line, realistic drums with, you know, the right kind of feel, or the right kind of changes. But then you can throw down an acoustic guitar, or you can start singing it.
Just to give you a little bit of a sense,
we'll start with playing a little bit of Steve's first original demo of the song, and then we'll play a little bit of the final version of the song, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about it.
Makes me blue. Then he said, let's paint the walls something new. She said, I've lost the strength to carry on. Me blue. And he said, we'll paint the walls something new. She said, lost the strength to carry on. Then he said, let's look one more day.
So what we were doing there is, at that point, the song is completed, but after Carrie had done the map, we shipped that back up to Seattle, and then Steve went back in and redid that lead vocal that you hear there, and the background vocals and some guitars, and then came back to you again, Carrie, and you added some more acoustic guitar and such to it to fill it out after that point. And then we brought in Dan Tomlinson's drums
Did I end up on bass on that one, or did we get, I forget who we got.
I think that was the one where Mark said he thought that somebody had already played a real bass on it.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that? That was pretty funny.
Oh, so he thought that our keyboard bass was a real bass?
Yeah, he thought it was a real bass, yeah.
Well, good.
That's the idea, right?
Uh-huh. I know Tom's got some questions for you about guitars. We used a lot of different guitars on this album.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of great guitars. Rex has a lot of great guitars. So, and you know, Andy's got a few great things laying around. So we had a real arsenal there.
Tom, what would you like to know about Kerry Jackson and his guitar arsenal?
I used to have one of the largest guitar amplifier and pedal collections in Northern New York.
Oh my God!
And I had to hide them in three different locations so my wife didn't know. But I did have, out of the 40 or 50 guitars I had two or three favorites that I just could not stop playing. And I'm wondering, of all in your collection, what would be your three desert island guitars?
Well, over the years, the guitars that I no longer have make me cry, so I don't want to think about those. But I have a lot of wonderful ones anyway that I now have access to. Plus Harold, the guy that I work with, I've helped him find a lot of great guitars, and he's bought a lot that I end up being able to use, and we've gotten some for his project, like a wonderful baritone guitar, that one Fender jazz bass that I've been using lately that I used on Rex's stuff was through Harold. He got this fabulous five-string bass that I use when we need a five-string that's called an Alien Audio, which is a little boutique company out of Nashville. The baritone guitar we have is an SG baritone, a Gibson SG, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Wow.
It can be single coil or double coil. It's, solid as a rock. It stays in tune. My guitars, funny enough, I had this old, well, now it's old. It's like a 95 or something. Ibanez Talman. And I don't know if you've heard of Ibanez Talman, but it was a little line that they put out in the mid 90s that were kind of imaginary vintage American guitars. So the Talman I have has three lipstick pickups in a Strat configuration. So I had it set up, and it plays really wonderful. So I use that one a lot. So it's kind of a small body Strat, but instead of Strat pickups with the usual five position switch, it's got lipstick pickups like an old Dan Electro.
Right.
I later found out that those Ibanez pickups were designed by Kent Armstrong, son of Dan Armstrong, who did the original lipstick pickups and who did all of the Dan Electro guitars. So that was a cool thing to find out. Then it turns out that Talman and Ibanez just a few years ago put out some new models that were very inexpensive. I got one for like under $400 because it played fantastic, and it's really a Tele. As far as the actual pickup setup, it's exactly off a Fender Telecaster. And the only Telecaster that was out then that I was really interested in was like a $2,000 guitar. And then like, here's this Ibanez that I got for under $400. That's a killer Telecaster. So I really like that. I have a Gibson SG that's really wonderful. That's a 2001, I think. And it's kind of a green, it's a flip-flop paint, like an old car, like in the light, it kind of shifts from green to blues. I have my Steinberger, the little headless electric. I got it so new that it wasn't even out in the stores yet. I found some guy who had worked with Ned Steinberger, and he actually got it as a gift. So my little headless Steinberger I've had since 1986. But I love all kinds of guitars. I have Jerry Jones guitars, which are very unusual, which are kind of high-end remakes of Dan Electro guitars. So I always got a kick out of that because the Dan Electros were very cheap. And when they came out in the 50s, they were made so people could afford them. Sometimes they were sold by Sears, and they were called Silvertone guitars. But they were still Dan Electros, and those had the lipstick pickups, and the bodies were made out of two pieces of masonite, and they were ridiculously cheap. So I
lived in the town where Dan Electros were made, in Neptune, New Jersey.
Neptune, exactly. And Jerry Jones even made some models that were called Neptunes, and that's why they called them that. So that's a cool thing. And so the cool thing about the Jerry Joneses I have is they still kept what was cool about the Dan Electros. They have lipstick pickups. The top and bottom of this semi-hollow body is made out of masonite, and it's over kind of a framework of hardwood. But then, unlike a Dan Electro, it has a beautifully made neck, and it's really wonderfully fretted. And my favorite Dan Electro, well, I have two favorites, I guess. One is One is a Guitar Lynn. That's what they used to call them when they were Dan Electros. Mm-hmm. And they also call them the Longhorn because of the body shape.
Right. And
those are unusual because they have 36 frets, right? We're like a Les Paul will have, you know, 22 frets and go up to high D.
So you got three and,
you know, something like the Steinberger or, you know, and some other guitars goes up two more frets to high E. This one goes a fifth higher than that. So it goes to high B above high E. So it's got so you can hit some unbelievable high notes on it. That's why they called it a gig. Now I kind of think of Rex in that gang. I think, ooh, 12 string rock. Tom Petty. Rex Anderson, Roger McGuinn.
That's a good company to be in.
Oh yeah, yeah. And
now, as you say that, Kerry, let's just play a little bit of the intro to Everything Leads to You that has some 12 string in.
The Big Blue Whale is my Jerry Jones 12 string, which also has lipstick pickups, and it's a really wonderful 12 string. However, on Big for His Age, I also played Rex's Rickenbacker 12 string. It was a little difficult because it has a very thin neck and you had to squeeze your fingers together and stuff. But boy, those Rickenbacker pickups and the sound of it, it was so fantastic that it was worth having to deal with that problem a little bit. Anyway, so both 12 strings are on Rex is saying, Rex being a big fan of Roger McGuinn and jangly rock and Tom Petty and all that stuff, which I am as well.
You know, Kerry, as we worked on the album and you did a lot of lead guitar work in addition to rhythm work using the setup that you were just talking about. One of the songs that closes out the album is called Holding On. And that song has a history in the live shows that we did. I remember us being up in Seligman, Arizona, playing a show, and we get to that song, and our bassist, not too far into the song, suddenly drops down on the floor and is playing on the floor. and then the whole audience comes forward and lays down on the floor all around us as he's playing. So that one had a build and an energy to it that was kind of unique because it was an interplay of guitars. And I thought it might be nice to just listen to a little bit of it and then talk about how that evolved. Because if you recall, Greg Anderson came in and played some ideas that he had about the lead guitar work that he had in his mind and kind of drawing on some of the live show things. And then you took a listen to that and kind of took it to essentially another level. So let me just play a little bit of that, and then I'll have you kind of comment on that process of listening to what somebody else is doing and then kind of trying to work with it, complement it, and enhance it.
Amazing, remarkably layered guitar tones in that song. I don't know how you achieve that, but it's just beautiful.
Well, it was really fun to have a nice idea to build off of. Rex brought me the idea. Who played it, Rex? Greg?
Greg, uh-huh.
Yeah, Greg, of course. And Greg had this really neat, almost, you know, flamenco idea on an earlier version that Rex had, and Rex said, man, I love this idea, can you build on it? And then earlier in the song too, there's kind of a little solo in the middle where we really feature that lick, and I love that stuff when I'm already given a theme or a melody, because I look at all songs like they're little movies anyway, because they really are, you know, like they're kind of put together the same way as movies, and you have your climaxes and your quiet parts, and does the whole movie work as a whole, you know, just like a film director has to take out really wonderful scenes where the acting was fantastic. it slowed down the movie, or it would distract the audience from the main plot. And that's the same thing when you're doing songs. You know, like, you can sit there all day and play cool stuff on the guitar, but that doesn't mean it ought to be in the song, right? So like, if Rex has some great song and, you know, I'm just out there shredding, it can be, yeah, he can play guitar, you know. I wish you'd shut up because I can't hear the song anymore. You know? So I love when you're already thinking of things in terms of movements and themes and stuff. And this wonderful idea that Greg had really gave me a direction to go in. You know, so we kind of started with his lick, and then when I did the little building Santana-ish, more, you know, sustaining lead stuff, I was still always keeping his theme in mind. And even when the guitar starts wailing at the end, you'll hear that lick, you know, popping in and out of it and stuff.
What was also interesting about that is you left some spaces in there so that when we took it up to Chino Valley and had our friend Darren Mahoney play the other lead guitar part on there, it was really nice to see you left space around there so we could really kind of do some question and answer back and forth between him and your playing.
That's right, too. That's another direction that you had already had in mind for the song. And I love that stuff. You know, like, that really helps, because sometimes the most powerful thing you can do, especially on something like lead guitar, is, you know, give it a minute, let it breathe. You know, but just go ahead and hold that badass note and not have to prove, you know, watch what my fingers can do, you know, or something. And by doing that, then Darren, who is a, you know, fabulous guitar player with an entirely different sound and entirely different guitar, it wasn't just a call and response, but the way that they weave in and out of each other and stuff is so great, because I think you have a couple of guys playing who are both thinking, how can this song build and be wonderful? Not, you know, how can I prove who's the best guitar player or something? And neither one of Darren or I are on that page at all. We love songs and we want to make songs be good movies and sound good. So I was thrilled when I heard the whole thing done. You know, it's so lovely to hear that is entirely different. He kind of has this cleaner sound with a real nice bite to it. He's kind of being a little more rock and throwing a little more maybe hint of Rolling Stones or something in it. And I'm sort of being, you know, Santana over here. So it's two very distinct things going on. And that's a whole different guitar. That's my Strat, which is not a Fender Strat. It's a T. Willie Strat, which is a little handmade guitar by a guy that builds guitars here in Arizona. But other than the fact that it doesn't say Fender, it's a Strat.
One area that we've talked about with everybody that's come on board is, what is your relationship with vinyl records? And do you recall that first piece of vinyl that you purchased as a kid and took a listen to?
Wow. Well, yeah, we all us old guys, I guess, get misty-eyed over vinyl records. Because well, for one thing, as I think we all probably had a point in our later lives where we had an epiphany where I hadn't heard one for a long time. And then I'm at a friend's house and he's got the Pretenders first album on vinyl. I haven't heard that in a long time. That'll be fun. And I'm just playing this old crappy record thinking that it's not going to sound pretty good, but I love the Pretenders first album, so it'll be fun to hear it. And then the epiphany was, holy, it sounded so good. I couldn't stand it. Those drums, that bass, it's just warm. It just talks to me. Oh God. And you know, that wasn't even a, you know, heavyweight, half speed, master, high quality. It was just some off the rack thing that, you know, he'd had for 30 years or something, and it still sounded that good. You know? But yeah, when we were all growing up, I think there's really something to the fact that you had to dedicate yourself to a record, you know, to where, okay, I got an hour or I got some time or I got the day off or whatever. Let me go over and pick up this thing that has a cover and a theme, and it might even have the lyrics in it, and it might even tell me who's playing everything. And then we would put it on the turntable and set that needle in and then just go sit down and shut up and have a wonderful time and not, you know, be hitting buttons and getting tired of it in 2 seconds. And I've heard 19 songs in 1 minute and all that crap. But just to actually, and then the artists of the time knew that they were making albums, and they knew that you were going to do that. So they would make something that they knew was a whole experience. And it wasn't just this song and that song. I mean, there's obvious cases, you know, Sgt. Pepper, I guess, probably almost invented the idea that the album is a thing that you play from start to finish and that you feel the whole, you know. But even long before Sgt. Pepper, you know, so many wonderful classic albums and from the 60s and way into the 70s had the thought in mind that we were going to sit there and we were going to devote our time to the experience of this work of art. And if they made this thing, they thought of it as a 45 minute work. And then there was just something so tactile, I guess. And so, you know, not that I don't love that in modern times, we can pull any music we want out of thin air. And I love having YouTube and I'm trying to learn a song or I'm trying to refer to something that I can just pull any song out of space is, you know, all that's fun and that's awesome. I don't take away from that, but there's nothing like that. I'm going to commit to this moment in time and be moved by this wonderful thing. And I was so lucky when I was growing up because I owe this to my mom and the Beatles, I guess. And maybe it's why I like the Beatles so much, is that my mom was super open-minded about music. So I grew up thinking it was the most ordinary thing in the world to come home, have records blasting when I got home from school, because my mom was young and she was cool and she used to blast records, right? And then, but my mom, you never knew what it was going to be. You know, like she would sit there, like if she knew that she had a day off, she would open up her 4-record set of Lucia di Lammermoor, the opera, and, you know, she would cry her eyes out while she was reading the book with the English translation, and she would listen to every second of this opera, but it was like 2.5 hours long. But I might come home the next day, and it would be Aretha Franklin blowing the windows out. And, you know, it was my mom who not only had this wonderful open mind, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and film scores, Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, Motown, Elvis, all the classic rock. You know, she just had this, but then when I was starting to be like 12, 13 years old, she would buy me stuff. You know, she'd be in Woolworths or whatever and go, "Hey, I heard this record. I thought you might want it." And then like, she'd hand me Electric Ladyland by Jimmy.
When Carrie was talking about his mother when she was young, my mother, when she was older, in her 70s, was heavily ticketed by a policeman because she was blasting NWA's album out of her Volkswagen and was pulled over for a traffic stop when a certain song came on about an attitude toward the police, which she loved. She had it cranked at top volume. And she received 3 tickets as a result of that.
So, Tom, do you have any other questions you want to kind of follow up with Carrie before we say goodbye? And Andy, also, from your perspective, if there's anything you want to ask before we kind of get to the end of this interview.
Yeah, there's one thing we didn't really talk about at all, which is the amount of vocals on the album and the amount of harmony singing. You and Carrie did almost all of that. So I don't know if you want to talk about that at all and how that got to be such an important part of...
Yeah, thanks, Andy, for bringing that up, because I did want to say that Carrie played a couple roles when it came to the vocals. Not only did he sing with me a lot of the background vocals, but he was also there as kind of a vocal coach for some of our, for myself and for some of the other singers that we had come in. But he has a kind of a natural way of coaching people and giving them an idea of what the possibilities are, being able to hear the different parts. So it's not uncommon that we might do a song and I might sing a lead vocal. I might even come back and double that vocal with just Andy and myself working on it. And then once we have that down, then Carrie will come in and we'll start talking about what do we want for harmonies here. Sometimes it's just a single voice and sometimes it's quite a few. So Kerry, talk about some of the kind of the techniques you use in getting these background vocals and those kinds of things accomplished.
Yeah, it's really important, like we were talking about with the guitars and everything, is to think of the movie you're on, too, is to think of what song that you got going. Because what's that wonderful waltz song that we did with all the mandolins and 12 strings and everything?
Twisted and Turned.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that beautiful song could have had, you know, walls of harmonies, but like you don't want to just get in the habit of trying to be, you know, Queen or something every time you do some harmonies. It's much more interesting if it varies from song to song and goes with what's cool for the song. So like in that song, the birds go to the Beatles' house or something, you know, and, you know, some answer backs and some more thick harmonies and stuff. You know, I liked the old man song. Where we have some lines that answer back and stuff.
And we kind of do the step up harmonies on that one too.
Oh yeah, that was a great idea. I think you had already had that idea in your head even before we started, right? Where rather than all the harmonies coming in at the same note, there's you, then them, and you know, coming in layers and stuff. And then like we did various techniques, like sometimes when we wanted fat harmonies, where if it's a, let's say it's a three-part harmony, but we'd like to have six voices, two voices on each part. Oftentimes Rex and I would just do that live. So rather than have like me stand there and sing a part twice and then go to the next harmony and sing that twice, that would work. I know how to do that. But I think we got a more ensemble live musical sound that it would be Rex and I would both sing the same note on that and do a live double. A lot of the Bee Gees used to do that a lot because they were already great singing groups. Rather than go in and do their individual parts, they go, let's record ourselves harmonizing. But then when we want to double it, when we want to fatten it, we'll go in and we'll do another live harmony as a double over that. And I know that Rex and I did that a few times on this, where like I might sing the high and he'd sing the mid. And then we would move to the next track and I would sing the high again, he'd sing the mid again. And now we'd have four voices, but they weren't four separate tracks done quite so sterile. It was still a couple of guys having fun on a mic and looking at each other and trying to be in tune and get our parts right and all that stuff. And I think you get kind of a magic result out of that.
It was also nice on the vocal sessions that we got to invite in some of the original Big Fruit's Age band members who used to play some of the live shows with us. So we had Gary Oreskovich and Kathy Anderson both come in and do some vocal sessions with us where they added in the background vocals on the song we were just talking about, Everything Leads to You, and also on Walk On. It was just kind of nice when you're working in a studio and kind of overdubbing a lot of things to get more people in the studio at the same time and get that energy of feeding off of each other. So that was really fun. I appreciate the time you spent with Kathy and Greg and
yeah, that magic really gets caught. Yeah, like you just can't catch that magic with a bunch of overdubs, you know, like it's just fun to have a room full of people singing and stuff. And then that's where my, you know, since I've done so many sessions and I know so much what goes into harmonies and stuff, I'm not really showing anybody how to sing, helping them or anything. But I'm good at sort of knowing where we are, keeping it focused. You know, they don't have to think so much, you know, like, oh, what are the notes? What am I doing? You know, I'm sort of keeping track of all that. And then like we can, and in a way that's kind of helping it be fun because I can be saying, you know, to Kathy, to whoever, And they'll even watch me conduct. I like to sort of hold up my hand and then, you know, slam it down because we're all going to cut off the note at the same time, you know, that kind of stuff. I think people really like that because it makes it more fun to do the harmonies because, like, you're not so worried about all the technical stuff. Someone's kind of already helping that part of it happen. And then I think they can actually be there having fun singing and not feel so much under pressure. You know, like I have to figure out 1,000 things here while I'm singing. You know, yeah, that was really great when we were all in there together.
Well, Kerry, I'm going to wrap this up here. We really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us. And obviously, we appreciate your contribution to the album. We're really looking forward to seeing it in its big, beautiful red vinyl and in the 180-gram black vinyl versions of it. Man. But thank you. And thanks, Tom and Andy, for sitting in with us on this interview. We appreciate you taking the time.
It was wonderful to see everybody, talk to everybody. I'm getting a kick out of the fact that we're all white-haired old men with beards in my little picture here, because I've known you guys for so long. And plus, I've been white-haired recently because of COVID. I thought, all right, we're going to forget about the hair dye now. You know, the hair's growing out. I haven't had a haircut since March, you know. And now I'm glad about it. I like it. I don't mind being a white-haired old man. At least we all made it this far, and I see we all have our rooms full of instruments and stuff, and that's pretty cool. We must be doing something right, because we're still doing music and we're having fun as a bunch of old men. So,
yeah,
it could be a lot worse.
Okay, well, take us out with a little bit of the last song we talked about, and that's Old Man with the layered background vocals.
I know. On the farm again.